Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today I'm going to be joined by Benita Roy. I wanted to have Benita on the podcast for a long time because I think she's just a brilliant mind. And we're going to be exploring today, what are these theories of change that we might hold at a societal level that we're swimming inside of that might then afford certain possibilities for transformation? In particular, we're going to be exploring this notion of complex adaptive systems and the beauty of that theory, but perhaps the shadow side of that theory. And Benita will share with us instead her notion of complex potential states and how a theory like that can actually open up new realms of change, new types of change, non-linear change, might I say. And so I think it's really fascinating for us as coaches to be able to explore this kind of thinking. It's maybe zoomed out from the up-close minutiae of transformational coaching and looking at things from a collective systemic level. We will also dive into Benita's theory of transformational education and these different selves that can emerge in our lives. This is definitely a podcast to listen all the way through because I think we begin to close the circle, wrap things up well towards the end of the podcast. Benita Roy is a philosopher, a teacher, an educator. She's the founder of the Alador Insight Center and C Labs, and she's also an associate of Perspectiva. Before we dive in, I'd just like to whet your appetite that soon we'll be announcing our new online coach training called The Art of Developmental Coaching for those of you that are passionate about working with your clients developmentally. I'll be back to tell you more about that in the coming weeks. I'd love it if you would share this podcast. I'd just like to get the word out to as many coaches and transformational practitioners as possible. And if you want to join our mailing list or check out what we're up to in general, you can head to coachesrising.com. If you scroll down the homepage there, you'll see a sign up box. You can join our ever-growing community of transformational coaches. All right, so that being said, let's dive in. Here's the podcast with Benita Roy. Hey, Benita, it's good to be with you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. You know, I was just thinking how much the world has changed since we last spoke. So there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, that's actually great you mentioned that, because there was a few things you said last time we spoke that really, I was like, they stayed with me, you know, like you were bringing in this idea that the nature of change itself might be changing. I don't know if you remember, crudely paraphrased you there, but so we might get into that. And there's so much we can talk about today, but I guess I want to start by asking you about what we were just checking in about, which is, you know, you wrote in one of your emails about replacing the obsession over decline and collapse with a concentration on transformation and potential, which I think for coaches listening would really resonate with that. But perhaps you could say like why you wrote that statement and where it comes from.
Yeah. So, if you think about decline and collapse, those words. So phenomenon happen, things happen, and then we add an evaluative filter. We evaluate that. And the way we evaluate that depends upon the mental models we hold. So if I say decline and collapse, that only makes sense in a mental model of a linear progression, right? Because there's progression. In order to think of regression, you have to have a concept of progression. And so when we speak of the decline of the West or the decline of an organization, it's always hidden in that is this little movie playing that progression follows a certain path that I had expected when I was on this step that maybe these next steps could have been possible. Those were in the direction of progress. So the first thing to do is to notice that you impute onto your evaluation of what's happening a measuring tape that has certain, you know, values or certain expectations you're measuring by. So there's this great scene in the movie, the new season of Billions, if you watch it, where he goes into the, you know, the coach, she's this really hot, very sophisticated business psyop person, you know, and he says, and he's stuck in a conundrum, and she says, what if you don't increase profits? Because he's trying to do two things at the same time and they're incompatible. And it never occurs to him to allow his profits to drop, because that might be in the right direction because of the mental model he has. They're hedge funders. I mean, it wouldn't occur to him, but then all of a sudden something clicks and he sees it. He sees that that's the nonlinear path. He sees the potential. Just at that moment, the whole view switches. So the first thing we have to understand and try to understand is, what measuring stick am I using? What are the values along those measuring sticks? We need to examine those. And what are the potentials to reimagine what I would just call a preferred future would be? So I'm not going to even use a better situation or worse situation. You know, what is a, could I imagine a constellation of preferred futures? So, and there's a lot of hidden opportunity in that. If you've run businesses that have gone through cycles, it's really exciting when you're expanding and scaling and making more money, but also, you know, you have cash flow problems and receivables and hiring is hard. And then when you're contracting and there's a local contraction, if you fixate on those metrics, you'll only, first of all, you'll be out of sync with the macroeconomic, let's say, factors or conditions, but you will fail to appreciate and leverage and play with the fact that, oh, I don't have a hiring problem. Oh, I can spend more time. We could slow down. We could spend more time with work-life balance. We could throw out that whole line and regenerate some of our interests. You know, these are the things you miss if you can't switch your measuring tape. And I'll just end, I'll let you comment and build on this. During COVID, I started watching a lot of chess. You know, I would work and watch chess. And of course, chess is hard, you know, it's like 12 hours and I don't really understand chess that well, but I do have some favorites players. So I was into who won and who didn't win. But what was interesting is some of the, what I noticed, or it was also said that the best chess players, they have strategies, but when let's say, they want to start with this opening move. I don't know, the cat land, they have all these terms. But then as they look and they're moving, all of a sudden they'll see, ah, this is not like that setup. This is like that setup. And they instantly move into that structure. And the best chess players are the ones who, even though they're pursuing one strategy, it's a mental model, they're very open to, oh, I see this pattern. I know this pattern. It has more advantage if I think of it within this mental model. So there's something like that that is operating in that statement I wrote to you. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's quite, you know, in particular circles now, particularly online, you know, there's, you know, maybe in the mainstream media too, this idea of decline and coming environmental crises as well, but I'm just so in a sense, like you might be pointing at like a meta idea of change itself, you know, like what are the meta narratives we hold, and what does that then allow for occurring? What does it allow for us that we're able to see? So I guess my question is, like, I'm wondering what model do we want to be putting down perhaps, and which ones do we want to be picking up instead that would allow for concentration on transformation and potential? Like, is it that in itself, or like, is there more nuance to like what we can say about the kinds of paradigms that we might be holding that we need to put down and the ones we need to pick up?
Yeah, so one of the things, you know, I know you want to talk about this, but I'm going to run through it quite quickly because I want to get to some other candy. There's more candy. So one of the things I've written about, it was in the Metamodern book, Dispatches from a Time Between Worlds, is that one of the overarching mental models we have of change, well, we have two mental models of change. One is developmental, which means that the next higher stage builds on the previous stage. And so you have to be 2 feet before you're 3 feet. You have to be 3 feet before you're 4 feet. This is an aspect of change, but it's somewhat trivial. And then we have developmental models that say cultures and organizations are like this, like the metamodern, that their cultures go through stages, developmental stages, which, because it's a developmental theory, assumes that it has to reach this stage in order to get to the next stage. And this stage, the next higher stage, is going to be built on this stage. So those are called stage theories. So that's one theory of change that we have. The other theory of change we have is evolution. But generally, that has turned into there's a whole discussion of whether or not it's original Darwinism or neo-Darwinism, or Darwinianism. But basically, when people think of evolution, they think about complex adaptive systems. And complex adaptive systems, which is all over organizational science, resilience and adaptivity and complex states and how do you adapt. This mental model is highly suspect because it guarantees epistemic closure. So what do I mean by that? Complex adaptive systems are like bacteria and antibiotics and pests and pesticides and nuclear war and nuclear defense. And when you get into the logics of complex adaptive systems, eventually the system closes on itself because everyone is adapting to everything, is adapting to everything else. And even though the system is enclosing or imploding, because so many of those movements everyone's adapting to everyone else, the system feels like it's heating up and getting more complex. It's getting more complex, but it's not expanding, right? So if you think about financial markets, like, we don't produce anything, but hedge funds now start to short, and then they produce another financial instrument to adapt to that, and blah, 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 blah. So as long as we look at systems and systems change through the lens of complex adaptive systems, I think we produce the world we're in now. And that is escalating complexity and escalating risk and epistemic closure. So this one's very hard to get out of because I've spent about now 12 years, I started with gardening. Like, what, you know, you put all this effort into gardens and then the pests come and you say, no, why are the pests here? What if I see there's a potential that is in the fact that the pests have arrived? And it gets very, very hard because your mind, then I want to adapt to, I'm still thinking of adapting to the pests, but I don't want this loop to be my epistemic lens of change. And so I have to say that, recently I wrote about complex potential states. I'm starting to really exit complex adaptive thinking, but it's a real discipline and it takes a long time. And I don't want, I could tell you a lot of gardening but I don't want to get into the specific experiments I run. But like I tell managers, like, don't strategize your employees because they're complex adaptive systems too, And so So I think that's on the threshold of a real transformational, real transformance in consciousness, let's say. And I've been writing about complex potential states, not because it's necessarily the thing, although I see the seeds of it in a lot of established writers like Christopher Alexander, Whitehead, Simone Den. You know, a lot of people have been sniffing around, and some physics, a lot of people, Stuart Kaufman, let's say, a lot of people have been sniffing around this. It's in our imagination. But I've been writing about it because it's one thing to tell people don't use the lens of complex adaptive systems thinking, but it's another thing. It's, you know, what are you going to replace it with? You know,
because do you mind if I ask, before we talk about complex potential states, like to help me get a sense of like how I might be thinking inside of that paradigm of complex adaptive systems? Like, it sounds like you're saying that there are these agents within the system that are all adapting to each other. And you said that it's not expanding. So I imagine, therefore, within whatever that, within the boundaries, it's all getting increasingly complex. And there's like struggles taking place, pressure. I'm just wondering, for everybody listening, like how that might look on an everyday level. Is it something that we're all swimming in continuously, or is it something that's showing up in particular places like the workplace, if you're a executive, for example? And if it is showing up everywhere, like how are we, could you point us to like how it might be residing in the very way we see the world? If that's possible, it might be.
I'll reiterate, it's the feeling of, kicking the can down the road. If I spray pesticides, the pests are just going to be more resilient, which means I have to create more pesticides, which means, so that's the feeling. Now, I can give you some examples. For example, when I left my career at the last recession, the depression, I started my own businesses and different initiatives. And for a while, I was always felt under threat, like someone's, when you're on the internet, someone's doing more than that, or I've got to outcompete, I got to be there more, I've got to write more. And when I started doing complex adaptive, isolating that kind of thinking, I would sit down every day and just, how can I add value to what I do? And sometimes I draw something, sometimes I read a little bit. If every day I add value, then it's going to create potentials. And sure enough, I'll get a call and I'm like, oh yeah, I have something like that, And so I'm not really adapting to anything. The first presentation I did on complex potential states was at four years ago, who knows, at Dave Snowden's Whistler retreat, Set Kenefin retreat in Whistler, British Columbia. And the presentation was, I said something like 10 years ago when I left my career during the recession, I wake up at night and I'd have these panic attacks because my whole life, my whole career, my whole life buying the farm, I had this plan, this is like this plan and the ducks in a row. And because they were big plans, they were 2 or 3 years and I was making more money every year and growing a business. And then I left and I would look into the future and there'd be nothing. We bought the farm just 2 years before the recession. And so we had a lot of debt. And literally I had this experience of looking in the future and seeing nothing. No, there was nothing, no place I was standing on today that would lead to the next. So not like a developmental pathway. And so I'm standing in front of this retreat of very interesting, important people. And I'm saying, now, how did I go from there to being talking to you and doing this presentation with two other keynote speakers? Like, How did that happen? And so I didn't want to tell a story of putting ducks in order, because that's exactly the story that leads you to think there were steps when there were not steps. And so I don't want to do that presentation, but that's how this question of complex potential states was lived in my life. Like, how I wasn't adapting to anything. I mean, I didn't, you know, there was a housing program where I refinanced without having to have a lot of equity in my home. That was the only thing I think I did. Half the time I just told people I couldn't pay, and I didn't try to work on the things that weren't working. Mostly because I had the advantage of not being I didn't have anything to work on them with. So I was kind of like free-falling. If I was somehow less free-falling, I would have done that. If I had seen any potential in trying to leverage this, and I couldn't get a job, there were no jobs here. I was at the top of my career. I was in that demographic that was seen as overqualified. So that's the lived experience that I had that started to open for me a front of thinking of a different way of experiencing change, of experiencing possibility and potential. And, you know, I got really curious about it from a speculative theory sort of way. You know, I've known that a lot of great transformations in world building have come from philosophers who do speculative theory. So of course the theory of complex potential states is kind of speculative theory, unless somebody adopts it to some kind of empirical research. So that's how it started. And just to give people an example, you know, I just want to make it real for people, because it was very real for me, you know, it was very real for me. So in terms of everyday organization, it's like, you know, I can see some of the seeds into it. Like when I was running my company and let's say a very valuable player, employee comes up and, you know, here it is, the yearly review, they're going to hit you up for a raise. There's this, like, I do something and then they do something and the next year they're going to ask for more. Or they're wondering where, you know, and so how do you not get into that game of where everybody's strategizing? This is like horrible if you're, and there's different ways to do that. In this one experience, this was a very talented manager. He ran the whole nursery and home operations where we stored all the construction material and the nursery material. And we worked for people like Oscar De La Renta and Scott Rudin and Henry Kissinger, who ran big estates. And they were always trying to steal him because they would want him to run their estate, right? So every year there was this pickle, because he'd have these offers from these famous people. And so there was this game going on. And and so he was Ecuadorian, and many of the people that he oversaw or managed, not all, were also Latino. And one of the things that was complex was that when we first started, if he got a raise, then everybody else assumed they should get the same raise because of the kind of familial relationships they had. And so when this thing kind of like started getting out of hand, I just said, Wilmer, this is my budget. This is how much I can increase the operations with. You divide it up. You have more insight into who's worthy and who's not. And I said, and if you take it all, that's fine with me. If you take it all for yourself, that's fine with me. And so now you see, I was just allowing the system to find its balance without meddling. So that's just a specific example. You know, one of the things that we have in, you know, one of the things I'm working on that's in my new initiative are things we call them concentrator codes. What they are, action protocols that are like little templates for doing things just like that. Like what is the abstraction? What is the protocol I used to make that move? So that's not as, you know, it's not as easy to take a tool out of a toolkit. Hopefully if there's enough of these stories around these kinds of alternatives that people have taken, there could be a transformation in, let's say, organizational science. You know, right now we look at different types of action logics in that are at play in organizations right now. And so there's, for example, a collaborative competition is healthy. So collaborative competition is you and I are playing chess or any kind of sport, but we're actually playing for the love of the game. And if you get better and beat me, then I get better and beat you, and the game evolves. So it's called collaborative competition. Curiously, people are allergic to that, which is unfortunate. Like the postmoderns are allergic to collaborative competition. But what the action logics that's most used that results from complex adaptive systems thinking is what I call leverage conflict. So leverage conflict is like what we have in our financial institutions. Like I can bet on something and short it at the same time. So I have leverage conflict. Or it's like when in these great movies like The Sopranos and Billions, when I'm up against you, there's a competition. I go behind your back and see what I can blackmail you with. So not only do I win, but you get pushed back. So there's more extreme forms of this, but almost all the strategic action logics in formal organizations operate on this leveraged conflict. And you see the world is like that. Mm. I'm going to give you now a concrete example I do in my workshops. So what does leveraged conflict look like? So we do this little experiment, this little game, where you have a little world, and in this world, someone sells baskets of eggs, and someone sells mangoes, and someone sells fish, okay? And in this world, one fish can buy one basket of eggs, one basket of eggs can buy one mango can buy one fish, and vice, it's all balanced out. This is what you start, and you take people, you put them in threes, and someone says, okay, I'm going to be the egg person. Someone wants to be the fish person. And someone wants to be the mango person. So you start like that. And I do it online. And then you put up the next slide. And you see that the egg lady, one of the seeds that of the mangoes, she's got a mango tree. And then you say, okay. And then you have people talk about how they feel, and the person with the that sells mangoes automatically feels threatened, right? Because now it's something weird happens. The fact that they have more mangoes than ever before devalues mangoes. This is because the economy is in relation of leveraged conflict, right? So then in the next slide, you see they're not very smart people. They're just little world people. And the next slide, one of the eggs that the mango person bought got warmed and became a chicken, and it's a hen. Okay, so now you have the chicken person as a mango. The mango person has got a hens, chickens that lay eggs. And you say to the fish person, how are you feeling? And the fish person's like, I'm feeling like I got a lot of power, right? And now you see, okay, what is it about this world that the production of more wealth and richness devalues them, and now the fish person has more power? There's something extremely fucked up about this world. And this is because we, our automatic go-to way of looking at value exchange is through the lens of leveraged conflict. So when you play games like this, like, to me, that's the kind of transformation that has to happen in the system at the level of understanding what kind of subjectivities have been produced by the world that we've been living in, and understanding that there is a potential as that world fades away, that it's a good thing, because these subjectivities are not necessarily, certainly they're not universal subjectivities. And maybe there's a lot of other potential in the human condition that can be, can emerge. And so, so that's kind of like the work we've been doing in the last 2 years.
So, there's a lot in what you shared there. And I kind of get the sense of how there's like recognizing the system, the systems and its heuristics or, you know, axioms or principles that you're embedded within, and then seeing what the outcome of that is, you know, like, and I guess taking into account, like, how well are we thriving or how well do we feel in this system? Is it creating human flourishing? And you're saying, like, these complex adaptive systems thinking that's so prevalent is actually has real issues with it. You know, it's creating stress and competition and scarcity or struggle, perhaps. And
it's creating leveraged conflict, not collaborative competition. So that's one thing. But I realized what I could say to wrap this up. So when you run that little experiment of the three markets, right? The three worlds with the fish and the people start to have very generative conversations. Like, one person says, well, why don't we license it so you can't sell mangoes? Well, now you understand why we license thing, and that's a scarcity, and why they had guilds in the Middle Ages. And one person says, you know, or you understand why you pay farmers not to grow crops. You know, you start to understand these things that are, look like perverse incentives. They are perverse incentives, but within the system, this is, and then people start to get very, very clever. Like, the mango person and the chicken person can create a coalition, like the EU. And so this is what's happening, is the system starts to get very complex because of all these creative ways people can keep balancing and rebalancing it, you know? Like, what if the fish person went out and got a goat? And all this stuff can happen. But the point of this is, not that there are, but the point is from that lens, the thing gets really complex. The point is, why is the mango person under threat in the first place? Why is, so, because the subjectivity is, you know, the assumptions of what human relation and transaction, the subjectivity itself has a bias. You know, so when I told this story to my class yesterday, this one woman said she worked, that's how she went to this place where it was more like a communal thing in New Mexico. And she said, you know, basically, if you don't, the reason why it puts people in a pickle is because I say one fish is worth, one basket is worth. So you have this, if you tokenize the value of transactional exchange, you get this subjectivity. So the question is, you know, if families don't do this, you know, if somebody made more, you know, made bread and you fixed the car, you don't then go and take a little ledger. Well, you know, fixing the car is equal to two. You don't do that. You don't tokenize. You don't tokenize value creation. And so, what is an economy what is a society, what is an organization that doesn't tokenize value creation is another question that will bring you away from the path of leveraged conflict toward and complex adaptive system toward some of these other ways of imagining reality.
Because yeah, that's what I'd like to ask you about now is what is on a like individual and collective level, how might we need to be transformed in order to start to operate in that way, collaboratively, enacting or manifesting these fields of potential or you know, artifacts or whatever it is that comes out of these fields of potential. And so I'm wondering, like, what is the shift we need to go through? What are the ways we need to change our thinking? And this may be like where the idea of like linear incremental change, those ideas we hold might need to be put down. You know, it might be that we open up the potential for exponential change or, you know, the sudden emergence of whole new realms of value and value exchange. So I'm just curious if we could speak into that whole side now, because I think, like, you know, coaches listening, some of them work with organizations, a lot of them work with individuals in organizations, and you know, everybody's struggling right now, and so yeah, I think people are really keen to hear like what could we start to do, what inquiries could we start to have that could help us open up and kind of grow beyond the rules and the systems we're immersed in.
So, you know, I know this brings us to, I know you saw my, four selves, transformational education. We have to rethink education, because when we talk about, let's say, moving to complex potential states thinking or these things, we're kind of like at the stage where Kant is describing these things, and we want to get to the stage where people are just enacting those things by default, right? So when you first look at it, it sounds hope like you have to have all this metacognitive sophistication to make the move. But the question is, how do we enact from this? So people moving through the system, then we've produced a different type of subjectivity, right? Because so this is for the listeners, just to know that when we talk about this at the beginning, it's like Kant seeing a new mind and identifying its features. But the hope is that it's just previewing things that are emerging already, that eventually we have the kind of subjectivity that doesn't have to work against our instincts to enact these types of behaviors. So that's very important, that because if we don't keep that in mind, we become more like you go into meta paradigmatic, and then you start working in hyper objects, and all this thinking in that direction doesn't get you, like, it has to be enacted. You have to have a theory, let's say, a theory of transformational education or a theory of the self, so that you can work on this from not a meta level. So right. Having said that, that's, I think, what you're asking. This is basically what you're asking.
Well, let me just check. So you're saying, like, in a way, like, it would be ubiquitous in society, you know, in a sense that we wouldn't have to think about it. We would just be like that, you know, we would be in systems that encourage that kind of way of being inside of us. And, you know, from young ages, people would grow up in that system, and therefore it wouldn't be like a struggle to keep taking a meta perspective, you know, exactly. Abstracting out, you would just be doing it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so to the same way that the sense of threat arises in the mango person when another person has a mango, it arises effortlessly, and now it's difficult. You have to be a metacognitive thinker to notice and try to dissect it. What we want is the new subjectivity to arise automatically and work for us as long as it works for us. I'm not sure the process is ever, you know, like, ever ending. So
how do we get there? Because I want to be in that place. That sounds great. You know, it sounds like, you know, infinite game type, I don't know, you know, place where we all collaborate and, yeah, well, how do we get there? Like,
So along this path of my work, the answer how we get there is a question of education. And again, it's we need a new, we can't use the same theories of change that are problematic to look at how the human changes, right? So if you look at theories of development, then it's two-stage like. So the question is, what is, like people call it a metapsychology. And so this is if this is a four-legged stool, this is the fourth leg of the stool. And that is, what we've already talked about is like the production of a subjectivity and kind of like the marketplace. In terms of my metapsychology, I say that the problem with this is stereotyping. Really good developmental theorists will nuance this, but their model still is a line. Whether you nuance it and say, well, you have to go back and regress and all this, our model shouldn't have to be so nuanced that it no longer says what it says, right? So in developmental theory, we start with what we might call core psychological schemas, which are, you know, this very early on in childhood, up to 18 months to 2 years old, where you have to distinguish self, other, and world. And you have to, you know, understand your sensory motor system. And that happens up to about 3 years old. If you know the Montessori system, up to 3 years old, children won't play with other children because they don't have the next level, which I call the communal self. It's horrible for all parents who are unaware, because you think your child is going to be a sociopath because they don't play with other children, but it's a phase or a stage. Okay, so then we in our educational system, when we go to school, by the time we're in school, we pretty much think that stage, the development of the self, other, world is over. And so we start teaching we start teaching the next stage. And in reality, those primary schemas need to develop or change or transform throughout the whole lifespan. But we think the six-year-old child coming first grade, that's over with. He can see, he can hear, he can move his body. He knows how to move objects and, you know, he knows that he's a self and there's other people. But this, and then we move on. So now that's done. Now we get to the next stage. Just like I'm 2 feet tall, that's done. Now I'm going to grow further. But this is not true. The transformations in the core self happen across the lifespan. So the first time you have like a sexual experience with someone you really meld with, you're like, what is self? What is other? The first time you realize your parents' head are in your mind, in your belief system, what is self? What is other? This, what is self, other, and what is world? And so then you go in and you start and post to wonder, what is the world? Is it in me or I am in the world? And then then you might have experiences where these boundaries are not so solid and they're porous, and then they move on to other things. And we don't have an educational system that tracks the core self's change over the lifespan. The way we do it is, if you have trouble and you have a porous situation, we pathologize it and you go to the psychiatrist, right? Or as these things change, like I get a lot of students that are 40 and 50 years old, they go into a program on transpersonal psychology, or they have to. But see, the problem is they're at a crisis in their life because there's been no bridge all the way along. you know, and they start to like deconstruct their ego and all this stuff because there's been a gap between the support of that core self. So one of the things from an educational point of view is that instead of a step like thing, we have a foundation, which is the primary schema, and that goes through transformations of the lifetime. And then the next level of the self is the communal self. So the first example, the communal self, is my family. I'm in a group. Okay. And the communal self also goes through transformations across the lifespan. But in order for that to happen, it both problematizes the primary structures and provides a scaffold for it to solve its problems so the communal self can grow. Now,
what do you mean by that? Sorry, you mean that if the core self is well developed, it will support the communal self, and then the communal self will then feed back into the core self?
Yes, because as the communal self starts to expand, like how large is your we? Am I for Ukraine or am I for Russia? Okay, this is a question of how large is your we? And as that happens, it'll put pressure, or it's a catalyst for the core self. Well, who is self, other, and world? And so then I have to go back down. I'll find that I have some work to do here, and then the communal self can grow into a larger we. Right. So they both support each other, and the need or the eros or the dynamism that the communal self needs to grow, then sometimes it has to catalyzes new growth in the core self. So this is not a stage model, okay? So, and then above the core self, above is only because some are more foundational, we have what's called the cosmopolitan self, which is, like the metamodern self, the one integrated neoliberal, basically urbanized nation state system or something. And the cosmopolitan self, this is coming from a Western, very Western model, but that's like the metamodern self up in the sky, is this cosmopolitan self. But the cosmopolitan self, actually, that's a production of subjectivity. The cosmopolitan self is the self that is threatened when the neighbor has a mango, because it's tied into the production of subjectivity in Western thinking. The problem with that, so we want a production of subjectivity, but the cosmopolitan self, I think, is highly problematic. And I think it's not the place to go. It's a pathological goal, because it parasitizes the communal. And so this is exactly what the mango game shows. Nobody says, well, can we be, they don't look at it as a communal. And so, for example, you have, you see this in the US, you know, there's a move toward rural family and communal living. We need to reboot the communal self, because we go from some kind of retarded core self to the cosmopolitan self in our culture. And we don't spend a lot of time, we've basically gutted the communal self. And so you see, when people try to start communes or live co-housing, we don't know how to do that. You can't just all of a sudden put these architecture in place for people to live together, because you have to revisit increase the capacity of the core self. You have to reestablish then the communal self. You have to support and grow the communal self. And then the question is, what kind of collective larger collective subjectivity can be produced. On top of that, that's not cosmopolitanism and doesn't parasitize, but has this generative interaction with the other layers. And I'll just bring this home. One of my friends, where I was working with my class yesterday, and this one woman said, she lives in Australia and they have a commons area, like places the kids can play and you can have large parties. Some of the built, so the architecture is like co-housing. And she's from Brazil, and she grew up with very strong communal extended family, aunts and uncles, and then professional affiliations. And when you had parties, there was a lot of family and associates and colleagues. But her husband is British and he grew up in a nuclear family. And when he goes to see her families, he's like, wow, they're all nice. And of course, he just feels the communal spirit. Now, and she said, look, it's not easy to have that many relations. There's always a lot of like, you know, this one got divorced and is sleeping with this, you know, this is communal life, is alive like that. But she said, but you know, he had his family and he was like, out of there. And now he became like a urban professional. And I said, okay, well, this is very interesting, because it was the same with my family. We had a very small nuclear family and it was strangling. It was like, it's like, once you graduate, you're out of there, because we think communal phase in our life is the family. And the family itself is not embedded in larger communal systems. This is what I'm saying. We've gutted the communal self. And so, yes, his experience is authentic, that the family is like, I'm so out of here, because it's also retarded. It hasn't been developed. And so then you just become a cosmopolitan self and you haven't had the experience of the increasing capacity of the communal self. And so this is why the way it's structured today, that cosmopolitan move parasitizes the parochial, because most of us, our parochial communal self was just our family. And it is, it's not, it's strangling. So that experience is real, but from this wider perspective, you can see, you can see how the model works.
I've got a lot of questions and some reflections that come up. One is like how this journey you're describing fits with this question of how can we move into this new worldview, you know, of like seeing complex, you know, and manifesting potential, basically. And if there is, you know, you mentioned like the core self, the communal self, the cosmopolitan self, it sounds like, what's curious to me is like the core self and the communal self both sound like, what would be the word? Like they're just aspects of us, but the cosmopolitan self sounds pathological. So I'm wondering if there's like a non-pathological like mode of that, you know, like, or a potential, you know, because it sounds like you're describing how the cosmopolitan self is part of this complex adaptive system mode. And I'm wondering what like the self that was in the other mode, the complex potential states mode, might be like. And just before you answer that, a reflection I've got is like, yeah, I'm thinking about, I've got a young family, and then I'm thinking, there seems to be a lot of people around my age who are wanting to live in community more, feeling that urge. Because I'm, you know, on the one hand, I see like, yeah, I have to get childcare because I want to do my job. So like, I've got my job, which I do like, but then I have to get money to pay for the childcare. So, you know, then you're getting that kind of buy-in there of like, you're kind of privatizing all these different aspects of your life. And so therefore, and then you've got a mortgage and then you've got like the weekend to go out and maybe do some things. But I guess what I'm pointing at is it's like, there's some good things that I love that, but there's also this sense of like being caught inside that system, perhaps, where everything is kind of commoditized and chopped up and it's kind of complex and you're in the struggle, you know, it's like, oh, we have to earn more money to pay for more daycare. But then, you know, like, oh, actually, if I just took the time off and looked for my daughter, then I wouldn't need the money. And I love doing that. So, you know, these are some of these internal struggles. And then there's this maybe idealistic idea of like community living where there would be distributed parenting, for example, and like these meaningful, more abundance of these meaningful moments where that I've had throughout my life, where I've been in community, you know, around a shared common goal, and that's just been incredibly meaningful and fun. And it's not that I don't have that anymore, but it's like, oh, I could be more of that in life, you know. And maybe that points to how there could be this transition where we find meaning and collaborative relationships that create value and artifacts in the world. So yeah, I get, but my questions are like, yeah, how does that, is there a version of the cosmopolitan self, which is maybe a version of like, that lives inside of not the adaptive system stuff, but inside of the complex potential states, mm-hmm. that can, yeah. And how that fits to like this whole idea. Yeah, this, yeah. Anyway, you got it.
I'll shut up there. That's because the way I described it, there is a confusion in there. So we have the core self and the communal self. They're very deep structures. And then it seems that human potential, there's another kind of thing that has the potential to emerge. And so what I call that is, what kind of subjectivity? So depending upon what the capacity of the core self and the communal self, depending upon their capacities, they engage world building activities, and that those choices produce subjectivity. But those choices in the larger system produce a certain kind of subjectivity.
When you say subjectivity, you mean like a certain kind of inner, you know, experience of being in the world, basically.
Well, like what you just described, and then of course I have to pay my mortgage and this and that. So it produces a certain kind of subjectivity.
Right.
The threshold for action is in one direction and not others, or the subjectivity where the mango person feels threatened. So I don't call, I even call it the cosmopolitan self. I probably did, but the cosmopolitanism is a certain kind of subjectivity. And so the question, your question we're asking is, and what you're rightly seeing is that we're not going to go back and be like local isolated communities, just the communal self, distributed communal selves. There's problems with that because when these communal selves bump up against each other, there's in groups and out groups, there seems to be, it's already emergent, this other layer, which is the production of subjectivity. So Marx, for example, talked about capitalism produces a certain kind of subjectivity. So yes, there is something superordinate to the core self and the communal self that is already in the potential of the human. And right now it produces the subjectivity we call the cosmopolitan self. And the question you're asking, which is fascinating, is what kind of subjectivity can be produced? But my answer to that is we can't get outside of the production of subjectivity to produce a new subject. It emerges from the work we'll do at the core and communal level. And then a new type of subjectivity emerges. So we don't have a lot of control over that because it comes from our world building activities, which depend upon the capacities built at these fundamental levels. So all the work is in the core and the communal self. And then of course we're aware of new potentials, new subjectivities that may be arising. But it's not like we can get outside. Like, yeah, that's what Marx tried to do, get outside and produce a new subjectivity called the proletariat and communism. You can't do that.
Yeah. So, if I get that right, what you're saying is we go back and do transformative work with the core self and the communal self, and then the new self is an emergent property of that. You know, it's
exactly.
Like you can't just from here determine what it is. It has to have a kind of requisite emergence to it. You know that it's emerging out of that, and therefore I'm like. And where are we in that process? You know, like, are we still like, we've got to go back and do this work with the core self, communal self. And we're nowhere near collectively doing that. Or do you feel like, you know, this massive sort of explosion of interest in mindfulness and meditation and yoga and self-help and trauma understanding, do you think that is part of people actually going back to do that work, and that actually there we might even see the seeds of that new self emerging already?
So we are all, this is already happening, just like when Kant was naming this, this change was already underway. And you know, if you're someone like myself and you're doing speculative philosophy, it's not the same as creating a fantasy novel. You're looking and you're seeing, oh, this is new, this is interesting, this is metamodern. That's the old thing. You're looking for some pattern that is in emerging authors that are saying things different, and that seem to be a constellation that is increasingly amplifying itself. So yeah, you see, like, you know, the Tao and people trying to create communities out of nowhere. There's a need, but then, so I look at that, that's a need in the system, and you understand why people escape their families, because it's a very parochial, but there's, you know, so it is speculative philosophy, but it's an inquiry into the nature of phenomenon that are emerging, and trying to make sense out of that, and being very vigilant that the activity is radical enough, so that you move, you realize that this theory of change is not working, and then you realize that you might work with that, and then you realize you can't assume that the developmental model of the human is right, and then this. So I wouldn't say it's an empirical exercise, but it's not a fantasy novel. So and the other thing is that when I like talk to John Varvakey or some other people who are doing this work, we have different models and heuristics, and we have to do semantic mapping, because what I call this, he calls this.
Right.
But because there's a lot of resonance, that gives you reason to believe that people doing speculative philosophy are looking at the same world and just making reasonable analysis of that same world, so that this gives you reason to believe that this is happening in the world and not just made up in your head. So yes, it's already happening. If you're doing this right, it's because you're just amplifying or highlighting or trying to scaffold the potential that's already in the system. And of course, it's reflective of its own theory, so that you're working with complex potential states that are already in the system. And by using heuristics, by writing a model, like I just said, you amplify these potentials. So you see, for example, again, I use an example from my class yesterday, that conversation about the Brazilian, like this was already in her experience and now it makes sense. And she said that, you know, and one of the things that she's been intuitively advocating for is that they have they do activities, so kids come together to do the activities, because right now kids play with other kids that are like them. And so she sees this as a limitation, right? And so in a communal, a real community, when you had like a bunch of blue collar workers, you'd go to work in the factory, there'd be an Irishman, an Italian, and you'd have to work with people you didn't like, you know? So she says, well, let's do something so the kids have to play with kids they don't like. So this is that's her intuition. And now she has this model that of the communal self that reaffirms that her instincts, like some of the people there think she's batshit crazy. So the potential is already in the system, and some of this, like your work, having conferences, talking about it, noticing that other people are seeing the same thing, even though your semantics are different. This all amplifies them and creates this, the potential state starts to catalyze. It's like a lake turning over. When it happens, it'll happen all at once. People will just see that, like, you can hardly think like that anymore. Like, you need effort to think of yourself as being under threat because your neighbor has more eggs than you do. It will be hard to think that way.
I think that's incredibly inspiring, because maybe we get circled back now to where we started, which was like replacing obsession over decline and collapse with a concentration on transformation and potential. You know, that maybe I'm as you speak, I get quite the internet comes into mind, you know, of like the how that's so amplified the amount of connections that are possible now, the spread of ideas, and I just feel that it's quite easy to get caught in that linear notion of change, where if I just look at the world and the environment and the war and the economic, you know, it just starts to feel like it's impossible, you know. But then when you talk, I think of the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, you know, how that just fell in the space. I don't know what the time frame was, but it wasn't possible for people to strategically coordinate the collapse of it. Something just popped into those nations, you know, that they all abandoned with it. I don't know how many days it took, but it was very quick. So I'm thinking of like, what is it that I see as I, you know, because I see these threads or these potential. I never thought of them as like states of potentiality. It's more like I'm just following my intuition and like pattern recognition mode. But it's like you start to see like, oh, ooh, like, and it's an embodied experience. Yeah. And maybe that's a good place to begin to go, is like, what embodied, the role of embodiment and what embodied practice might we take on in these times? But I'm following that sense of like, oh, yeah, like actually there's something here, what Benita's talking about and how that connects with the things that we talk about in the, you know, in the transformational coaching field, and how that connects with what John Vivekie's talking about. And if I would say that there certainly seems to be some themes around people expanding their bandwidth out of just pure abstract reasoning, rationality into an embodied experience, like where cognitive science comes in with the sense of an embodied self. But like that, yeah, it seems to be that's part of a theme that's happening. And even another part I would say is like the hyper individuality, like people seem to be becoming, recognizing how Western that notion is and the fallacies of it, and that there's, you know, that communal self perhaps, but like how like in a lot of cultures they're grown up with a very different sense of identity, which is based more on relationship. And so these are some themes that I see strongly, like people working really like in honoring the complexity and transformation rather than the complicated, you know. So this sensing unfolding, this meta competency of unfoldingness, as opposed to structural close the gap type change that's been around in coaching. And so these are some like threads of like something that I really see coming in more into the transformational field. So I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this, but I like just wanted, it just came up as a reflection. And I guess I'll just see how you respond. And this idea of like embodied practice stays with me too. And I'm like seeing the time, and I'm like, we could have 3 hours in this conversation. We've got, another 15 minutes. So.
Yeah. So the embodiment piece, I think, is intuition is the embodied perception of deep patterns that are emerging. You know, to me, it's kind of like watching new stars being born, you know. But if you're always just looking for the Big Dipper, you just don't see anything. But it's about, you know, it's like being the James Webb telescope and looking beyond into the space where new stars are being born. And that's what intuition is. And it's not an intellectual exercise. In our environment, it requires discipline, though. So because if you're in the West, and there is reason to believe that the West peaked in influence in the 1920s, when after World War I, three people, Winston Churchill, the Duke of someone, and someone else, I forget, they pretty much laid out the plan for the rest of the world. And Western influence is declining. So like one of the most surprising things is Eileen Gu wins three medals in freestyle skiing at the Olympics. She's an American-born person who goes to Stanford, and she lives in California, and she won the medals for China. She chose to be on the represent the Chinese team. If that doesn't tell you that the influence of the West is declining, then you're just being blind. And so these are natural rhythms, and the discipline is, okay, I'm in the West is declining. What is the most graceful way to decline? And, okay, it's like when the things turn over, the things that were not possible, the things you're talking about, I have to pay a mortgage, I have to do this, I have to do that, those things are dying. So there is a new potential that's going to emerge. And if we only concentrate on preserving the things that are declining, that the West is dying in global influence. It's not dead. It needs to compost itself. And let's say China and then India, the new influences, they're going to go through their own cycle. And these cycles seem to be coming faster and faster. So it's like China is not an emerging power. It was way ahead of the West for centuries, and then it declined, and now it's emerged. So one of the questions is, what is the potential in this declining state? That's why I wrote in the dispatches, you know, the chrysalis, the in-between, is hardly ever welcomed, but it has more potential. It has unique potential to be consciously aware that when a state is in decline, the potentials that were not possible when the old structures were dominant are rising. And your coaches rising. And that is the question of our time. And that, you know, there are many people who are not at the leading edge of this. There are people who have to fight the wars and still make hedge bets on Wall Street, but that's their job to do. But people like your audience who are interested at the leading edge, that's the work of our time. What is the unique potential in the decline of the West? And so we could create something, some subjectivity that has never existed before, because we can be self-conscious in the decline of its unique potential. And that, I think, is the work we need to do.
Boom. That's, you know, high five to that. That's well, I can feel what that evokes inside of me, you know, which is, it's part, you know, what you're doing right now is helping me land inside of that sense of potentiality, because I get this embodied sense of the deep sense of service and grace and joy that can come in recognizing there's a decline, but not, you know, immediately going, oh shit, you know, like decline, how can we respond to that? How can we protect the order, or, you know, maintain power, or whatever that is? But instead, and actually to see that, hey, the joy of the decline is that there is actually more potential here. You know, if you're not in decline, if you're at the peak of power, I imagine it's actually very difficult to experiment, or more difficult. And it's just more difficult. I lost what I was going to say there, but it's very inspiring to me to hold that as a kind of frame. And it softens me, you know. I can feel a kind of like a peaceful acceptance and sense of grace and desire to serve that comes through.
Yeah, and the potential of a new spring, you know, like kind of saying my organization is dying, and then 10 years later saying, yeah, we used to work together to make money. Now we stay together because we're friends and we're doing this service. And there's so much possibility. And it's just to bring it to practical, there's a lot of aspirational energy in this, but, you know, I dropped my career abruptly. We had just bought the farm. My income went literally down to nothing. We were both contractors riding on the housing bubble. And my husband's was a contractor also. Everybody around here is contractors. There was nothing going on. And I would just do the numbers. Like, it was impossible to stay alive. But even the numbers turned out to be polluted by subjectivity. And what happened was I realized that I had a certain subjectivity that, like, if I didn't do this, then my horses would die. If I put all this effort into the tomatoes, but in reality, they grew better if you just let them alone on the ship pile. Everything that I ever learned was that tomatoes would mold on the ship pile, but because the ecosystem is healthy, that didn't happen. Like, little by little, I just realized that I was living in an reality that made everything more expensive, made my time, I didn't have any time, that, and all those structures transformed in the process of just one at a time, you know. And like, nobody can change, you don't want to go from your life as you described it to like, I'm going to sit at home and see what happens. But you having this discussion, you change one little decision at a time, and there's a domino effect. You get more and more space, more and more time. Having more time, you have time to relate to people in a way, and you realize, oh, that's a really nice person. And then they take care of your kids because they have kids, and these potential relationships are already in the system. And that's something to be very positive about.
Yeah, it does feel that way. It feels like it's close, or it's here, you know, it's just not recognized or seen. So I was going to ask if you had a recommendation, but I guess you're giving one now. But yeah, I wonder if there is a recommendation for people, like an inquiry perhaps, that they could take away, or
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it'd be nice to have a conversation around this conversation, which I think has been really, really great.
There's a potential for that. Well, then let me suggest that we want to know how we can find out about your work as well. You know, I know you're up to some cool stuff and
I kept on alluding to my class. I've created a simple school, a simple campus that runs on a Substack, simple Substack. It's not a newsletter, it's a campus. It's called the Pop-Up School. So it's at BonitaRoy@Substack.com, where you can search for the Pop-Up School. These are the kinds of conversations we're having, and we're building a kind of we're building new models to talk about things like this, and it's a work in progress. The fact that I could speak quote unquote so eloquently today is because I just ran the subjectivity 2 months for that course, and in this dialogue we get more clarity around what a lot of us, the shared intuition a lot of us have.
Mm-hmm. Great. And that's BonitaRoy@Substack.com.
Yeah, or I think you can Google the Pop-Up School.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how.
Great.
Yeah.
Bonita, thanks so much. I feel like we have to do another conversation. There's like a lot of unanswered questions out of me. But yeah, I really appreciate you being willing to play in this space and speak. Yeah.
Yeah, you're doing really unique work, and you have... it's lovely talking to you.
Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com, put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.